I collected all the knives I'd thrown at the various dartboards. It was a surprisingly high number, given how little time I'd had. But I guess stress makes me stabby. And returned to the small office that was going to be my bedroom for the foreseeable future. My bed was an air mattress on the floor with a quilt I didn't recognize and a pile of pillows that I did. I threw myself onto it with more force than was necessarily safe and rolled onto my back, staring at the ceiling. My lease was almost up. The Sasquatch whose apartment I'd been using was going to be home soon, which was supposed to be my cue to go back to Oregon, assuming she came back at all after the message I'd left for her. Mom and Dad would understand that I couldn't leave while the threat of a purge was hanging over the city. We've always done fieldwork in emergency situations, and the Covenant was the next best thing to a natural disaster as far as most cryptids were concerned. But what was going to happen after that? I came to Manhattan to prove that I could make it as a professional ballroom dancer. Only things didn't actually work out that way. I hadn't managed to win a single major competition. The times I'd placed, it had always been local, and the prize money I'd received barely paid for the cost of my registration. It didn't touch my costumes or the hours of studio time I had to beg, borrow, and steal whenever I could. Most people in my tier of the profession supplemented their income teaching classes, but I couldn't even do that anymore. Trying to be a cocktail waitress and a cryptozoologist took up too much time. Quit bussing tables and I couldn't afford to eat. Quit taking care of cryptids. If I quit taking care of cryptids, I wouldn't even know who I was anymore. I pulled a throwing knife out of my shirt without thinking about it, flicking it toward the ceiling. It flew in a satisfyingly straight line, embedding itself in the wood with a soft thunk sound. The fact that throwing knives into the air while I was on top of an air mattress was maybe not the smartest idea, barely even crossed my mind. I was too busy thinking. I came to New York to dance. The cryptozoology was supposed to be a sideline, something I did to keep my parents happy while I proved that I could have a career if I wanted one. But somewhere along the way, the proportions got reversed. I started spending more and more time with the cryptids who needed my help, and less time fighting my way through the cutthroat world of ballroom dance. My partner, James, had to chase me down for rehearsals. If it weren't for the fact that he was cutting back his own availability while he prepared for Chupacabra mating season, he probably would have talked to me about seeing other partners by now. As it was, I was braced for that conversation. James was decidedly gay and extremely devoted to his husband, Dennis, who put up with more than any human married to a goat sucker could reasonably be expected to endure. But sexual preference didn't matter during mating season. Chupacabra never raised their young in the presence of both biological parents, something about it increasing the odds of the pups being eaten before they get old enough to become intelligent. The ways of Chupacabra biology are strange, and not for me to understand. Yet. I was about to lose my apartment, my partner, and my chance at ever having the kind of career I dreamed of when I was a kid. As a professional dancer, I was on the cusp of failing. At the same time, the Covenant of St. George was in my city. I'd been forced to go into hiding to avoid having them find me, and I had no game plan for getting rid of them. As a cryptozoologist, I wasn't doing much better. All I could really swear to doing correctly was being a member of my family. Too pig-headed to know when I was beat, and too contrary to admit when it was time to run away. I sat up, tucking the knife I'd been about to throw at the ceiling back into my shirt. That was the answer I'd been looking for. It didn't matter if my dancing career was over, or if I decided to put on a red wig and become Valerie Pryor full-time. No matter what, I was a price girl. And if there's one thing no price girl has ever voluntarily done, it's back down from a fight. I'd been living alone long enough that it was weird to need to tell people where I was going. I still tracked Mike down and made sure he knew I was heading for Sarah's before I left the slaughterhouse. He asked when I'd be back. I barely managed to bite back the urge to tell him that I didn't have a curfew and stomped up the stairs to the roof. The night air was cool and smelled like big city, that heady mix of human bodies, cooling pavement, and 1,000 clubs and restaurants venting their private atmospheres into the greater ecosystem of the metropolis. A city the size of Manhattan is like a rainforest or a desert. It has its own ecology, its own secrets, and its own dangers, its own predators. Good thing that I was one of them. It didn't take long for me to reach Sarah's hotel, even with the necessary detours and slowdowns created by the variable architecture of Manhattan. I maintained a dead run all the way, burning off the barest edge of my frustration. The Port Hope was the lowest building on its part of the block, being only 5 stories high. That was useful for my purposes, especially since Sarah was staying on the top floor. I couldn't jump straight from the roof of the high-rise next to it, so I got out a climbing hook and lowered myself 1 floor at a time, pausing on the narrow brick lips that marked the base of each new floor to adjust my rope. Once I had a good grip, I'd start down again. When I finally reached the floor slightly above the roof of the Port Hope, I unhooked the rope and jumped. I hit the roof as gracefully as can be expected for a human girl leaping 6 feet straight down. The best landings only happen when there's no one there to see them. Paradoxically, the same is true for the worst ones. If you're going to break an ankle or something, you're probably going to do it when there's no one around to hear you shouting for help. I held my crouch for a few seconds, indulging my paranoia as I waited to see whether I'd been followed. No one appeared. I straightened and walked to the roof door. It was locked, naturally, but the faint static that told me I was in the presence of a telepath who knew me was crackling at the back of my mind. Sarah was home. I paused to center myself, trying to clear my head of any useless thoughts. "Sarah, are you there?" "Very?" Her answer was tinted with a strong feeling of confusion, like she couldn't figure out where my thoughts were coming from. Understanding, her understanding, washed over me a split second before she added, "What are you doing on the roof? How did you even get up there?" "I jumped," I replied. "Can you come and let me in? The door is locked, and this place is low enough that the only other way for me to get out of here involves rappelling down the side of the hotel," which wasn't something I was opposed to under normal circumstances, but it might lead to some awkward questions, especially since I'd be going inside right after I reached the sidewalk. "I'll be right there," thought Sarah firmly. The feeling of connection died, although the static remained. Telepath here is a signal she can't stop sending, no matter how hard she tries. Much as I love her, I actually find that a little bit reassuring. It proves there's one thing the cuckoos can't control, and given how many advantages they have, I appreciate knowing that they're not perfect. I'd been waiting on the roof for less than 5 minutes when the door swung open, revealing Sarah. She was in her usual, "I am a normal college student," attire. Orange sweater, jeans, and scuffed-up white sneakers. Sarah is a natural Daphne, designed by nature to be boy bait, but you never know it from the way she dresses. I think she'd rather be a Velma. Sadly, nature didn't give her a vote in the matter. "You were supposed to call," Sarah chided me, as she stepped out of the way to let me into the stairwell. "There are these things called doors that normal people use." "I'm using a door right now," I protested, half laughing. "Yeah, because I had to let you off the roof," Sarah shot back. "And you did a fabulous job of it," I said, patting her shoulder before I started down the stairs. "I seem to remember a promise of room service." "Room service and not freaking out," Sarah agreed. "Also, Artie may call at some point. He wants to talk to you. And no," she put her hands up, "I don't know why. It may be for something totally unrelated." "Well, yes, but I think it's a little more likely that he wants to yell at me, don't you?" "Probably," Sarah agreed. We were still laughing when I opened the door at the bottom of the stairs, stepped out, and found myself nose to nose with Margaret Healy. I'd never seen her up close before. I didn't need to, because there was no one else she could have been. This woman was family. Her hair was the same shade of chestnut verging on red as my sister Antimony's. She still had it, pulled it into a ponytail, showing the cheekbones we had inherited from our mutual ancestors. Her eyes were a clear shade of hazel. Antimony's eyes are blue like mine. But aside from that, Margaret could have been mistaken for my sister. She blinked at me. I blinked at her. Sarah, still laughing, crowded up behind me.
"Why are you just standing here?"
"Oh." Her laughter died like a switch had been flipped, replaced by a look of utter bafflement.
"Oh. Hello."
"Verity, I didn't know you had company. Why can't I see her?" There was no sign in her voice that she recognized Margaret as a Healy. That sadly made sense. Cuckoos recognize people by thought, not by appearance. To her, all humans look essentially the same. She can tell races, genders, hair colors, and that's about it.
"Hello,"
said Margaret. Her accent was British. She looked past us to the stairs.
"Is the roof of this hotel a hopping night spot, then?"
"No, we're just stargazers," I said, taking hold of Sarah's arm and tugging her with me as I stepped out of the stairwell into the hall.
I kept my eyes on Margaret, and kept a smile plastered across my face. If Sarah couldn't see her, she must have been wearing some sort of telepathy blocker. Not a good sign.
"I wanted to show Sandy here the Pleiades."
Sarah looked even more confused, but nodded enthusiastically, saying,
"They were shiny."
I shot her a sharp look. I didn't need to bother. Margaret was nodding in time with Sarah. There was a faintly glazed look in her eyes. Sarah was freaking out in her own quiet way, and that meant that her natural camouflage was kicking in. Anti-telepathy charm or not, it's hard to counter a cuckoo who's actively putting the whammy on you, and Sarah's survival depended on Margaret accepting her as a natural part of the setting. It seemed to be working, thank God. If Sarah said she'd been looking at stars, well, then she must have been looking at stars. My backpack was large enough to hold a telescope. The story made total sense.
"Is there anyone else up there?" asked Margaret.
"No," I said.
"Then I think I'll give these stars a look myself. Thank you for letting me know they were good tonight."
Margaret stepped into the stairwell, closing the door behind her, and Sarah and I were alone. I made a small squeaking noise in the back of my throat and started towing Sarah down the hall toward her room.
"What's going on?" she asked.
"No talking," I said. "This is walking time, not talking time." Sarah wisely shut up until we reached her suite, where she unlocked the door and led us both inside. I followed her inside. Then I shut the door, locked the deadbolt, and resisted the urge, barely, to shove a chair under the knob. Sarah watched this whole process, her bewildered expression deepening.
"Verity, who was that woman? Why couldn't I see her properly?"
That was Margaret Healy. What was she doing at the Port Hope? There were hundreds of hotels in Manhattan, maybe even thousands. So why would the Covenant pick this one? They weren't going to be interested in the math museum. So why? Unless someone told them I might be here. Someone like Dominic DeLuca, who had been to the Port Hope before, and who had been around Sarah often enough that he might have been able to remember the location, even if he forgot why it was important. I felt myself go cold. Here, then. This was what I'd been waiting for. He'd betrayed us. He was the enemy. I didn't have to feel conflicted anymore.
So why didn't that help? "The brunette?" asked Sarah, gaping. "She's a Healy?"
"Yeah." If I could recognize Margaret as a relative, it was only a matter of time before she was going to start thinking that I looked oddly familiar. Like a picture she'd seen once in a history book, next to a paragraph titled, "Traitor."
But what's she doing?
I don't know, Sarah. Probably assessing the roof for tactical defense purposes. Which meant, assuming she had any training at all, which she must or they wouldn't have sent her, that Margaret was going to notice the scuffs in the gravel that marked the place where I'd hit the roof from above. She'd be able to read those marks like a hunter reading a deer's tracks in the wood. Something humanoid had jumped from the next building over. It had recovered without injury. It had gotten off the roof somehow. and she'd encountered two women coming out of the stairwell. Sarah's cuckoo camouflage might slow Margaret down for a little while, making her second-guess what she was thinking and try to come up with other reasons for us to have been up there. But that couldn't work forever. Cuckoos work best when they stay near their targets, and we'd moved away from Margaret as quickly as we could. Factor in Margaret's anti-telepathy charm, and I had no idea how long she'd be confused. "What do we do now?" "Get your things. We're getting you out of here." Sarah's eyes widened.
"But I just got here."
"She saw me!" I didn't realize I was going to shout until it was too late to stop myself. Sarah took a step back. She didn't actually go pale. Her blood isn't red, and her biology doesn't support things like blanching or blushing. But she may as well have. Her expression told me how frightened she was. I didn't stop.
"Even if she forgets about you, she saw me. She's going to know that there's something wrong here. You know how badly the Covenant wants to get their hands on a cuckoo? Do you want it to be you, Sarah? Because I don't."
"Verity, you're scaring me," she whispered.
"I don't care. You should be scared. We have to leave, Sarah, and we have to leave now, or we're not going to be leaving at all."
Sarah stared at me for a long moment. Then, in a small, tight voice, she said,
"I'll go pack."
She wheeled and stomped off toward her room. It was more fear than anger. I didn't care either way, as long as I got her out of here. The idea of what might happen if I didn't was unthinkable, and so I did my best not to think it. The existence of the cuckoos wasn't proven until my great-grandfather went to Colorado to look into the movement of a local hive of Apraxis wasps. Before that, there had been rumors, but never any hard proof. One of the last communications my grandfather sent to the Covenant before cutting off all ties was a letter describing everything we knew about the cuckoos. Warning people about them was more important than hiding information from the Covenant. That's how dangerous we thought they were, and how dangerous we still think they are. According to our contacts in Europe, the Covenant has been trying to get their hands on a cuckoo for research purposes ever since. It's one of those things that causes a lot of ethical debate at home, since we have a shoot-on-sight order on most cuckoos, but they're still sapient beings. They deserve better than the Covenant's idea of study. If Margaret figured out who I was, and what Sarah was, she could kill two birds with one stone. Take out a member of a traitorous branch of the family tree, and finally get a cuckoo they could take apart at their leisure. They just need to keep her unconscious. Cuckoos can only scramble your head when they're awake. All the discussions I'd had about the danger of staying in New York had included warnings about keeping Sarah safe, and endless reassurances that of course I wouldn't let anything happen to her. Of course she would be fine. She was a cuckoo. What was going to hurt her? What, if not a Healy in the same hotel, with the potential to recognize her for what she was? Dad used to joke about Healy family luck, how sometimes it was good and sometimes it was bad, but it was always interesting. Margaret Healy clearly had that kind of luck, and she had it in spades. Sarah emerged from her bedroom with a small suitcase in one hand and an overstuffed backpack in the other. "Let me get my laptops and my homework from the table and we can go," she said. She didn't sound happy. I didn't blame her. We'd been planning a relaxing evening out of the line of fire. Having the fight follow me to her door was never the idea. "Where are we going?" "You can stay with the rest of us." The dragons weren't going to be thrilled about me turning their old nest into the new Grand Central Station, but with as much as we were paying them, they could cope. "Oh, goody. Slumber party of the damned." Sarah started for the dining room. One thing about her taste in hotel rooms, she never gets anything smaller than a suite, and she's never had a suite smaller than a good apartment. It seems extravagant, and maybe it is a little, but it's really one more precaution against having her brain come melting out of her ears in the middle of the night. Living as a telepath in a non-telepathic society was definitely not all wine and roses. Someone knocked on the door. We both turned. "Did you order room service before I got here?" I asked, instinctively dropping to a whisper.
I realized only after I spoke that I probably should have done it telepathically.
No, said Sarah,
who was smart enough to do what I hadn't. There was a soft thump as she put down her bags. Then she stepped up next to me, squinting a little at the door.
I can't hear who's out there. I'm not sure there is anybody there.
One more problem with being a telepath in a non-telepathic society? Sometimes there aren't words for the things you're trying to describe. Sarah doesn't really hear people thinking, but there isn't any other way to say it. It gets clearer when she's attuned to a person, and strangers can sometimes be almost inaudible to her mental ear. Still, she usually knows when there's someone to be listened to. That means it's Margaret. Maybe she'll go away. The knock came again. Maybe not, I thought. I looked toward Sarah.
Okay, here's what we need to do.
You're going to say I have to jump out the window, aren't you? She asked miserably.
No, of course not.
Not that I didn't want to. Going out of the window would have solved all our problems. Unfortunately, I didn't have the equipment to get Sarah down safely, and she didn't have the training to do it without help. I took a deep breath and thought, as reassuringly as I could,
"We just need to be quiet, okay? She'll go away."
Verity, I don't like this. Sarah's lower lip quivered, her eyes wide and frightened.
I know.
I drew a pistol from inside my hoodie, gesturing for Sarah to get out of sight. She started toward the coat closet, presumably to hide herself. There was a click as the latch released, and the hotel room door swung open. I managed to jump behind the half wall that separated the living and dining rooms, getting myself out of sight before I could be seen. Sarah gasped.
"Can I help you?"
she asked, in a surprisingly normal tone of voice.
"Your door seems to have been left unlocked," said Margaret Healy. "Can I come in?"
"Oh, shit."
Chapter 13. Blood is thicker than water, but family isn't just about blood. Family is about faith, and loyalty, and who you love. If you don't have those things, I don't care what the blood says. You're not family. Alice Healy. A suite at the Port Hope Hotel, about to potentially get into a firefight.
Sure,
said Sarah. I heard her step back to let Margaret into her suite.
Is there something I can help you with? It's an awfully cloudy night for looking at stars, don't you think?
The question was mild, just a comment on the weather. There was nothing mild about the chill that it sent racing down my spine, or Sarah's sudden, terrified cry of,
"Verity, I think this is the woman from the roof."
Sometimes Sarah's inability to recognize people by visual cues can be a real problem.
I know, I thought back, as soothingly as I could.
Try to convince her that you're harmless. We're going to get you out of here. It'll be okay.
The sky cleared for a little bit, said Sarah. That's why I went up with Valerie to see the Pleiades.
It's odd that you can see them at all with all the ambient light from the city, said Margaret.
I was ever so excited until I saw that the clouds had come back. Quite fast, too. I've never seen a cloud cover that thick develop so quickly.
Verity, why is she asking all these questions? She should have believed us. Why can't I see her?
I don't know, I thought back. See if you can make her leave. We need to get you out of here.
I guess the weather does what the weather wants to do, said Sarah weakly.
I suppose that's true.
I heard Margaret take another step.
Is Valerie still here? I wanted to see if she had any other suggestions for places where I might go to do a little stargazing.
No, she had to leave, said Sarah. I'll tell her that you were sorry to have missed her.
Left? Really? That's amazing, since I had a splendid view of the front of the hotel while I was on the roof, and I didn't see her going out.
It must have been while you were going down the stairs.
That's still quite impressive timing.
I'll have to ask my colleague who was sitting in the lobby this whole time whether he saw which way she went. I'd love to see her again. I didn't need to be able to see Margaret's face to know what it looked like. Her tone was one I'd heard before. From my sister, my mother, my grandmother. It would be accompanied by an almost feral smile, one that implied the speaker would think nothing of ripping your throat out with her teeth. A dangerous expression for a dangerous girl.
"That's probably a good idea," said Sarah in a small voice.
"Unless you'd like to tell me where she went."
"Verity!"
I gritted my teeth, forcing myself to stay where I was. "Is she actually threatening you? Or is she just asking pointy questions and waiting to see whether you crack? Do you see any weapons?"
"Not yet. It's just questions. But I still can't read her."
"Shit. The Covenant has wards against sorcery, witchcraft, and the various Pisonic powers. Telepathy isn't common, but empathy is, and a ward against one will go a long way toward blocking the others. Sarah wasn't going to get any readings off Margaret, and Margaret wasn't going to be as affected by Sarah's particular brand of mindfuck as she should have been.
"Try and make her leave," I said,
keeping my mental voice as reassuring as I could. I didn't know how well it was working. Sarah's the telepath, not me. There was no telling how much interference she was going to pick up from my own panic.
"The staff will smuggle us out of here if you can make her leave."
"I don't know where Valerie went," said Sarah. Her voice was barely shaking. I have never been so proud of her. "Why don't you go ask your friend? He can probably tell you which way she turned when she left the hotel."
"Doesn't she live around here?"
"No, New Jersey. She was just visiting me for the day."
"Ah, well, if you see her, can you let her know that I..."
The sound of the theme from Dance or Die suddenly blared from my front pocket. I fumbled for my phone, hitting the mute button, but it was already way too late.
"What was that?" asked Margaret,
all pretense of friendly curiosity gone. She was a hunter, and she had just received confirmation that her prey was nearby.
"My phone," said Sarah, hopelessly. "If that was your phone, what's that on the couch? You have two cell phones. That seems a bit excessive, don't you think?"
I heard Margaret turn and start to walk.
"You sure your friend left? Seems a little odd that you'd hide her from..."
There was a heavy smacking noise, followed by the thump of Margaret collapsing to the floor. I poked my head around the wall. Sarah was standing with her legs braced wide, a decorative vase in her hands, panting in what I recognized as terror. Margaret was sprawled face down on the carpet in front of her. The fall had hiked both her coat and blazer up in the back, revealing the gun she had tucked between her shirt and pants.
"Get the gun," I said, moving to grab Sarah's bags. "Do you have any duct tape?"
"Why would I have duct tape?" Sarah asked. She dropped the vase. It landed without breaking, rolling to bump to a stop against the base of the couch.
"Is she dead? Did I kill her?"
"No, but she's going to have one hell of a headache." I trotted over and shoved Sarah's bags into her hands before dropping to my knees next to Margaret, producing a roll of electrical tape from my own bag. "Duct tape would have been better, but this will hold her for a while. You have 4 minutes to grab anything else you want from this place. We will not be coming back here. Understand?"
"I understand," whispered Sarah, and ran for the dining room table.
I learned the basics of tying up, or taping up, an unconscious opponent when I was still in elementary school, mostly by using my siblings for practice. I flipped Margaret over and got to work, moving a little slower than I would have if I hadn't been searching her for weapons at the same time. She was armed for bear. Acid-spitting, fire-breathing bear. If I hadn't already known she was a relative, the number of knives I took out of her coat would have made me suspicious. Even with that complication, I had her bound in less than a minute and a half. I shrugged my backpack off and began cramming her weapons into it, pausing only long enough to be sure the guns were resting on empty chambers and nothing was bugged or tagged with tracers. The last thing I did was remove her necklace, a thin disc of what looked like pure copper floating in a vial of water mixed with crushed herbs. I heard a gasp behind me before Sarah thought, "I can feel her in the room now." Swell. I was right. It's an anti-telepathy charm. I shoved Margaret's necklace into my pocket. They're more prepared than I wanted them to be. Someone had been telling stories. Dominic was no longer a friendly.
"What are we going to do?" Sarah whispered.
"Run." I stood. "She'll be pissed when she wakes up. We'll exit through the kitchen. We can hail a cab and have them drop us at the 9th Street PATH station.
And from there?"
"From there, we walk." I turned to face my terrified cousin, ignoring the blood relative who was lying unconscious on the floor. At the moment, Margaret was the least of our problems. There were two more Covenant operatives in the area, three, counting Dominic. And for all I knew, they were both in the hotel. "Come on, Sarah. Let's get the hell out of here."
I managed to shove Sarah's two smaller laptops into the suitcase. She held on to the third one, hugging it like a teddy bear. We took the service elevator down to the first floor, where Sarah babbled something about an angry ex-boyfriend waiting for her in the lobby to the supervisor on duty in the kitchen. The supervisor, a tough-looking African-American woman with the sort of eyes that have seen all the dark things a city has to offer, might have believed us even without Sarah's telepathic push backing up the story. We were two women alone, and we were obviously scared, even if I was doing my best not to show it. Sarah was just the icing on the cake of conviction. The supervisor nodded at the right places, frowned at the right places, and showed us the route through the kitchen to the back door. She didn't ask why we didn't want to call the police. Odds were good that she had her own answers for that, and that they weren't much better than our reality. Sarah was crying by the time we made it outside, huge, crystalline tears running down her cheeks. She was beautiful when she cried, since her face never got flushed and her eyes never got red. She just cried, a pale doll of a girl with eyes that seemed too big for her face. We walked along the back of the hotel. Running would have attracted too much attention, to the nearest corner that wasn't visible from the lobby. A cab pulled up almost immediately. We didn't even need to hail it. Sarah's semi-audible waves of distress took care of that part. Much as I hate cabs, Sarah's not a runner, and even if she were, we couldn't risk the Covenant having their third operative stationed somewhere at roof level. If we were followed back to the nest, we'd be sitting ducks. I ushered her into the vehicle as quickly as I could. 9th Street PATH, I said, once we were safely in the cab with the doors closed and the subtly tinted windows between us and the rest of the city. The cabbie looked dubious, an unusual reaction from a New York City cab driver. But that was traveling with Sarah for you. It's harder for her to keep certain things under control when she's upset. The poor guy was probably already starting to think of her as his niece or his best friend's daughter.
"Are you sure you don't want to go somewhere safer?" he asked. "Like the police, maybe."
"The PATH station," whispered Sarah. Then more loudly she added, "Please."
It was the please that did it. The cabbie hit the gas and we rocketed away from the curb, merging into the traffic as it flowed past the Port Hope Hotel. I gritted my teeth and forced myself to watch the sidewalks for signs of pursuit.
"Sarah, breathe," I thought, as soothingly as I could. "You need to calm down, or you're going to convince this guy that you're his long-lost daughter, and we're going to wind up being taken home for comfort and casserole."
I could have done with a little comfort, and I never turned down a good casserole. Having grandparents from the Midwest will do that. But this was not the time, and there was no reason to start dragging innocence into the line of fire.
"I'm trying," said Sarah, her mental voice barely above a whisper. "That woman..."
"I know." I put my hand on Sarah's knee. She shuddered and slumped against me, resting her head on my shoulder. I wanted to tell her to watch the street, to keep scanning for anything that looked out of place. I didn't. I couldn't. Sarah may be a part of the family, but she's not a fighter. She's never had to be. I didn't know how to tell her that was going to have to change. The cabbie dropped us at one of the entrances to the 9th Street PATH station, making one last attempt to convince us to go somewhere safer
before he allowed me to pay his fare and drove away. Sarah had a tendency to stiff cabbies. Not intentionally. She just never thought about needing to pay them. But I didn't want this guy to remember two upset girls who got a ride out of the goodness of his heart. Anything I can do to make us less unusual was worth doing.
"Now what?" asked Sarah, once the taxi was pulling away and we were alone in the inevitable crowd.
She clutched her laptop to her chest like a talisman, like it could somehow protect her from what was going on around us.
"We go down," I said. I took her suitcase, hoisting it easily, and motioned for her to follow me down the steps into the station.
I didn't realize before coming to New York City that the city was actually served by two different subways. There's the municipal subway, which covers the island of Manhattan and shows up in a lot of movies and TV shows. Then there's the PATH, the Port Authority Trans-Hudson train system, which connects Manhattan to the nearby state of New Jersey. Lots of people commute to work from Jersey City and Newark, allowing them to enjoy the benefits of being right by the Big Apple without also enjoying the high cost of living. Sarah and I paid our single-trip fares to get into the PATH system. Then we walked to the end of the platform, where I checked my phone to be sure that I had the right schedule in mind, took her hand, and pulled her down into the darkness. Things I do not recommend trying at home. Navigating an active subway system in the dark, knowing that if you're wrong about your timing, you're going to find out what it feels like to be on the losing side of a squirrel-meets-semi-roadkill scenario. Things I do recommend trying when there's a chance that you've been followed by members of a pseudo-religious order that would really enjoy the opportunity to wipe you from the face of the planet. Risking that roadkill scenario. I knew the way along the tracks, but the Covenant didn't, and we'd have ample opportunities to escape if they did decide to pursue us into the dark. Besides, only a crazy person would walk between stops when there was a nice, convenient train. If the Covenant was following us, they'd hopefully assume that we'd taken some secret shortcut down into the sewers and waste time looking for us there. In its own way, this was the smartest, stupid thing we could possibly have done. Sarah and I stuck close to the wall, walking as quickly as we dared. I didn't pull out my flashlight, much as I wanted to. That much light would be a beacon for anyone who happened to be looking for us.
"Sarah?" I murmured.
She jumped a little. I squeezed her hand.
"Are we alone down here?"
"As far as you know."
Sarah took a deep breath. I glanced back and saw that her eyes were starting to glow faintly.
That was a good sign.
As long as she had something to focus on, she wouldn't dwell on the fact that we were potentially being followed by people who'd been equipped to block telepathy like hers. Margaret had lost her charm and was hence visible to Sarah's specific way of looking. The others weren't. "Two hide-behinds watching us from behind the service door. Homeless man asleep in an alcove. Family of bugbears passing through," Sarah reported finally. "And rats. Lots of rats."
"Which means none of Bill's servitors have been through here recently." "That's good." Servitors were the lizard man's servants of William the Dragon. They used to be humans before they were kidnapped and mutated by a snake cult. These days they mostly skulked around in tunnels, eating rats and trying not to be seen. Nothing gets complicated like a cryptid ecosystem.
"It is?"
Sarah sounded anxious enough that I doubted she even realized she wasn't speaking aloud. I squeezed her hand.
"It is. There's nothing down here that can't defend itself." I was including us in that statement. I had my weapons. I had Margaret's weapons. And I knew my environment. As long as we could avoid being flattened by a train, we were almost in the clear. The tracks ahead of us were becoming easier to see. We were almost to Christopher Street. I started walking faster, pulling Sarah with me. The light from the platform was like a beacon guiding us home. We were almost there when the tracks began vibrating under my feet. "Run!" I shouted. We ran. When we reached the platform, I boosted Sarah up, ignoring the startled looks from the people waiting for their train home. I threw her suitcase after her, Then I grabbed the edge of the platform and vaulted myself clear, my feet moving out of the danger zone a mere second before the train came rushing into the station. My heart pounding in my ears, I bent forward and braced my hands against my knees, panting.
Lady, you okay?
Fine. I lifted my head, forcing a grin. My good Samaritan recoiled. I guess my grin wasn't all that reassuring. Sarah, come on. We have to get out of here. Wordlessly, Sarah grabbed her bag off the platform and nodded to me. I took her hand again, and we ran for the tunnel connecting the PATH station with the subway. If we could just catch the train, we'd be safe. We caught the train. The ride from Christopher Street to the meatpacking district was short, which was a good thing, since I don't think either of us could have handled a long trip bundled into a metal box full of strangers. Sarah kept her head bowed and her eyes closed, looking for all the world like a wilted flower. I knew that meant she was scanning the people around us constantly, looking for signs of danger. She was going to have one hell of a headache by the time we reached the nest. I couldn't say that it wasn't worth it. When we pulled into our final destination, I tugged her out of her seat and led her, eyes still closed, out of the train. I didn't leave the station. Instead, I walked the both of us over to the benches against the nearest wall and pushed Sarah into a sitting position, whispering, "Keep looking." Then I pulled out my phone. Uncle Mike answered on the third ring.
"Where are you?"
"Hey, Mom, I picked up that movie you wanted." Translation: I may be under surveillance. I am currently at the train station. If I'd been on the street, I would have picked up the dry cleaning. In a bus station, the groceries. It was a simple code, but it worked more than well enough for our purposes.
Shit. Sarah with you?
Yes, that sounds good.
She's been compromised?
I'm pretty sure.
Shit.
This time, the profanity was delivered with far more feeling.
What can I do?
Did you check the mail today? I'm expecting a package.
Sure thing. Hang on the line.
I heard the soft clunk as Mike put the phone down, followed by the equally soft, but far more ominous, snick of a crossbow bolt being slotted into place. Sarah's eyes were still closed. I put my hand on her shoulder and waited, feeling like an ingenue in a bad horror movie. At any moment, the Covenant would burst out of their hiding places and take us out, and no matter how hard I fought, there was no way I'd be able to hold them all off. We'd be overwhelmed, and no one would ever find our bodies.
Very. You there?
I'm here.
The coast is clear outside the slaughterhouse. If you can get up to street level, I can cover you.
We're on our way. I shoved the phone back into my pocket and took hold of Sarah's arm, pulling her to her feet. Come on, we need to go. She opened her eyes, the last of the glow dying from her pupils as she turned to look at me. Is it safe? We'll find out. This way. I led her out of the station and up the stairs to street level. Uncle Mike was standing in front of the tiny bodega that connected to the nest. I wanted to run to him. Instead, I walked at a conservative pace, pulling Sarah along with me. When he saw us, he nodded and stepped back inside, holding the door open until we got there. We followed him in, and he closed the door behind us. We were safe at last. For now. The question was, what were we going to do to make sure we stayed that way? Chapter 14. The worst thing in the world is burying family. The second worst thing is telling somebody else that they'll have to do it. Enid Healy. The meatpacking district, which is nicer than it sounds, inside a converted warehouse that's sort of beginning to resemble a clown car with all these people in it. Eastis and Ryan were waiting for us in the main room of the slaughterhouse. Ryan looked concerned. Eastis looked faintly bored and was chewing on something that looked suspiciously like the bottom half of a rat. I decided that asking would be a bad idea if I ever wanted to eat again. The Covenant is staying at Sarah's hotel, so Sarah's staying with us now, I announced.
Are you both okay?
Asked Uncle Mike. Sniffling, Sarah shook her head. Then she nodded. Then she shook her head again. I came to the rescue, saying, "We're shaken up, but we're fine. Ryan, do you want to show Sarah to one of the open offices so she can put down her things? She's going to be here until all of this is taken care of. It's not safe for her to go back to her hotel. It wasn't safe for her to go back to any hotel if the Covenant had charms that could block her telepathy. That was the only natural defense she had." "On it," said Ryan. He offered Sarah a faintly bemused smile, clearly not sure why she looked familiar.
"Can I take your bags?"
"Okay," whispered Sarah. She handed him the backpack with her schoolbooks and homework in it, and I handed him her suitcase. She kept hold of her laptop, still hugging it against her chest like a talisman. Then she wandered off after Ryan, following him toward the nearest set of stairs. Eastis followed them, still chewing on her probably a rat. That was good. I wanted a few minutes alone with Uncle Mike. The two of us stood silently until Sarah and the others were up the stairs. Then he turned to me and said,
"Report?"
I reached the roof of Sarah's hotel without incident. She came and let me in. We went down the stairs and were met in the hall by Margaret Healy, who was warded against Sarah's telepathy. Someone must have warned her that she might be dealing with a psychic. Someone like Dominic. I should have been more suspicious from the very start. But then again, hindsight is the only perfect vision. Margaret arrived at the door to Sarah's room while we were trying to clear out. She picked the lock, and once she was inside, she started demanding to know where I was. Sarah was trying to convince her that I was already gone when my phone rang. Shit, my phone. I still don't know who called. I reached for my pocket.
"Stick to the main narrative," said Uncle Mike, holding up a hand to stop me. "What happened then?"
Margaret realized Sarah had been lying about me and started to move deeper into the room. So Sarah hit her from behind with a vase and knocked her out. I almost allowed myself a small smile. It was pretty darn brave of her.
"She's had some good examples," said Uncle Mike. "Then what?"
I searched Margaret for weapons and tied her up as best I could with a roll of electrical tape from my bag. There was an empty car table nearby. I shrugged off my backpack and walked over to it. I haven't had a chance to see what all I got from her.
"Show and tell was always my best class."
I dropped my bag on the table.
"Then let's study."
Margaret had been carrying over a dozen knives, three guns, two pistols and one mouse gun that had been concealed in her sock, a garrote, a blowgun, and a variety of darts, some of which had tiny corks on them to keep her from getting scratched. I handled those with the utmost care.
"Is that everything?"
asked Mike, picking up one of the knives. "Not quite." I pulled out a set of brass knuckles and a lead-filled sap, dropping them on the pile.
"That's it. Well, that, and this." She had it around her neck.
I reached into my pocket and produced her anti-telepathy charm, holding it up for him to see. Mike whistled, long and low.
"That's some serious hoodoo. You think she made it herself?"
"There are a few spellbooks and grimoires in the family library. Rumor has it they all used to belong to Grandpa Thomas, which explains how he was able to make a deal with one of the Netherworlds before he disappeared. No one in the family has messed around with magic since. We Prices may be foolhardy, but we're not stupid." "I don't know," I said. "If she's a witch, she didn't show it. And she was wearing the charm, which would have messed with any magic she was planning to use."
"I'd have expected a tattoo, not a necklace, if she wasn't the crafter."
"Unless they wanted her to be able to take it off," I said. "Maybe they've started using empaths to prevent more defections. There are at least 8 naturally empathic cryptid species, and some of them are human enough, or harmless enough, that the Covenant might be willing to let them live if they seemed to be useful. It wouldn't be the best life for a unicorn or a cough god, but it would be a life, and that was more than the Covenant was usually inclined to offer their kind."
"Then she'll probably be in trouble for losing it."
Mike looked at the charm thoughtfully.
"You sure it works?"
Sarah started picking up on Margaret's presence as soon as I took this off her, so, yeah, I'm sure it works.
But does it work for people who aren't her?
Only one way to find out, I said, and looped the chain around my wrist, drawing it tight. The effect was instantaneous. The soothing static of Sarah's close presence cut out, replaced by silence. There was a shriek of dismay from the walkway above us, and Sarah ran into view, grabbing the railing and leaning far enough out that I was briefly afraid she might lose her balance and fall.
"Verity, are you hurt?"
"I'm fine, Sarah, I'm fine." I unlooped the charm from my wrist, holding it up so she could see what was going on. The static immediately snapped back on. A mild headache came with it, like whiplash from that brief psychic silence.
"We just wanted to see whether that necklace I took off of Margaret was what she used to block your telepathy."
"It was," said Sarah. She was looking at me like I was a ghost.
"Please don't do that again. I thought you'd died or something."
If I'd suddenly vanished from her view, that was an understandable thing for her to think. "I won't," I said, and put the charm back down on the table. "Did they find you a room?"
"Yes, but there's no internet in this building."
Sarah looked even more distraught.
"Artie's going to be so worried."
"So call him." That would probably worry him even more, since the Covenant found me and they have telepathy blockers, but don't worry, I'm fine, wasn't the world's most reassuring statement. That couldn't be helped. "We'll get the network up as soon as we can, but none of us is a computer genius, and it hasn't been a priority." Mike eyed me.
"I work in network administration."
"Only one of us is a computer genius, and it hasn't been a priority," I amended. "Maybe you can help Uncle Mike get things set up. In the meanwhile, call Artie. Tell him you're not dead. It'll probably be good for your nerves."
"Okay," said Sarah, and turned, vanishing back into the office.
Ryan and Eastus appeared a moment later, heading for the stairs.
"This day just never lets up," I muttered, finally fishing my phone out of my pocket.
I opened it and scrolled to the missing call log. Then I blinked.
Shit. What?
The call I missed while I was at Sarah's. It was from Dominic.
Verity.
No. I'm not letting him know we suspect him. Suspect my ass. Margaret had a telepathy blocker. I was ready to lock him up and throw away the key. Still. I hit redial, raised the phone to my ear, and waited. Dominic picked up before the first ring had finished.
"Are you all right?"
he demanded. "Yes," I said as calmly as I could.
"Barely. Is she?"
"Peter found her before she regained consciousness. What did you hit her with? A brick?"
Actually, it was Sarah. She managed to catch her from behind with a vase while she was looking for me. Nice timing on the phone call, by the way. It nearly got me captured.
"Oh, God."
Dominic sighed raggedly. I realized for the first time how worn he sounded, like he was being yanked in too many directions at the same time.
"I need you to do me a favor. It may sound like I'm trying to walk you into a trap, but I swear I'm not."
I was done believing him when he said that. I was still willing to play along. "I'll listen if you'll answer me one question."
"Anything."
"Are you the one who told them they needed to be using anti-telepathy charms?" If I didn't ask, he'd suspect. Margaret's charm was missing after all. Dominic's sharp intake of air wasn't quite a gasp, but it was a close cousin.
"The what?"
"I'm taking that as a no."
"Is Sarah all right?"
That was the only good question he could possibly have asked. "She's shaken, but she's not hurt, and they're not going to find her again. If I'd been thinking, I would have moved Sarah the second the Covenant came to town." I didn't think. "What do you need me to do?"
"Get to Sunil and Roshak.
The plan for tomorrow includes sweeping their neighborhood, looking for signs of cryptid inhabitation. They need to shut down the cafe and get out of there." Shit. Even if this was a trap, it wasn't one that I could ignore. Sunil and Roshak were even more defenseless than Sarah, and they thought they were safe. Dominic and I were regulars. They knew us. They'd open their doors for him and welcome him in gladly. I couldn't save their sister. If there was a way for me to save them, I had to take it.
On it, I said.
Thank you.
Just take care of yourself, okay? I'm worried about you.
You're not alone in that.
Dominic laughed unhappily.
Sometimes I wish I'd never come to this cursed city. It's changed everything.
Life does that, I said.
Yes, but...
He stopped mid-sentence. I waited for him to continue, only to finally realize that the silence on the other end of the phone was absolute. He wasn't even breathing. I pulled the phone away from my ear, checking the screen. The connection was dead. He'd hung up on me. Or someone had hung up for him.
Well, I said with a sigh, isn't this going to be fun?
I'm going with you on whatever fuck-crazy errand you just agreed to, said Uncle Mike.
I looked up and smiled thinly. I stand corrected. This isn't going to be fun. This is going to be a party. Convincing Sarah to stay behind wasn't nearly as hard as it would usually have been. She'd been scared, and that was something she wasn't used to. Uncle Mike got her set up in one corner of the main room with a pile of computer pieces I didn't recognize. She settled into connecting wires and configuring settings, looking happy as a clam. I guess we all have our comfort zones. Traveling with Uncle Mike meant I couldn't take the rooftops, but didn't need to hail a cab either. We rode in his sedan, blending smoothly into the traffic around us. If the Covenant was watching for me suspiciously, they'd know to be watching the high ground. Hopefully, being on the roads would keep me under their radar.
I wish I could convince her to go home, I said, sinking deep into my seat.
Mike didn't need to ask who I was talking about.
Any chance of that died when these people got charms to block themselves from her view, he said. No way she's getting on a plane when she won't know whether one of the other passengers is planning to kill her.
Maybe we depend too much on her telepathy.
We've all got our skills. There's no shame in depending on them, just in falling apart if things don't go exactly the way you were planning. Since you're not doing that, I think we're going to be okay.
Mike turned onto a one-way street without checking the sign to be sure he was traveling in the right direction. Judging by the parked cars around us, he wasn't.
So, we've got a rogue Healy, and our cuckoo's benched for the duration. We still have two bruisers, you, me, and all your folks from work. What about these boys we're going to pick up?
They may not want to come with us, and we won't force them. They're Madura.
Huh,
said Mike, and kept driving. After a few minutes had passed, he added,
Guess that'll save us a few bucks on spoiled food.
I smiled a little. Guess so. Having a Madura around retards food spoilage and decay of all types. Bread stays fresh for weeks if there's a Madura in the neighborhood. No one's exactly sure why. Alex thinks they may be natural bacteriophages or something, but it's hard to say without a lot of invasive lab work, something none of us are particularly interested in performing, and absolutely zero Madura seem to be interested in volunteering for.
You really think we're driving into a trap?
This time I was the one who was quiet for a few minutes, thinking about the question. Finally, I said, I honestly don't know, Uncle Mike. I want to believe him. I want to believe that Margaret being at the Port Hope was just a horrible coincidence. I can't, quite. At the same time, I never gave him credit for being this good of a liar. I glanced toward my adopted uncle. Either way, I guess we're going to find out in a little while.
Two against four.
Mike smiled. It wasn't a comforting expression.
Sounds just about fair.
Assuming we don't plan to walk away.
Who does?
He shook his head.
You know you can't trust him anymore, hun. He's trying to serve two masters. The Covenant and his heart. That never works out for anybody in the long run.
I sighed. I know, I'm just... I guess I'm still holding hope for him picking the right side.
Right for him, or right for you?
This time I didn't have any answers at all. We drove down the streets in silence,
and I hoped as hard as I could that when we reached Gingerbread Pudding, we would find Sunil and Roshak alive and well, and I wouldn't have to make